because you are righteous, and there is no righteousness in us. You are good, and our goodness could never approach the mark that you had set for us. We could never balance the scales, so you would say, that's enough good. And so Jesus had to come, and he lived a perfect life, and he died the death that we deserve to die, and he rose again to prove that he could give both life and forgiveness to us. He put his spirit in us so that we could know you and walk with you, even in a personal way. And you've done it all. You've done it all by giving us your word so that we could understand who you are and understand something of your ways in this world and what you're up to. And so, Spirit, speak to us. Give us ears to hear. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Good morning, fellowship. Good to see you. Take your Bible and turn to Mark chapter 5. If this is your first time with us, we want to welcome you. We are studying through the Gospel of Mark because there are a lot of opinions, personal opinions, and theological perspectives in our world today, in our culture today, about who Jesus is and what Jesus came to do. And what we're trying to do is go back to the earliest written account of Jesus' life to rediscover or to discover who the real Jesus is. Because it's so important, as we've been saying over and over again, if you don't see Jesus as he really is, you won't be able to experience the life that he's made possible. And so we've come in our study to Mark chapter 5. I'll begin reading in verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet, and he begged and he pleaded with him over and over again, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Would you come and lay your hands on her so that she might be made well and live?" And he went with him, and a great crowd followed along and thronged about him. There was a woman who had been sick for 12 years. She had a discharge of blood, and she had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. And she had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, because she was saying to herself, "If I can just even touch his clothes, I would be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. But Jesus, perceiving that power had gone out from him, he turned to the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples are like, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. The woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before Jesus and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house someone who said, "Your daughter is dead. Don't trouble the teacher any further." But overhearing what the man had said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And when they went in, Jesus saw this commotion, people wailing and weeping loudly. And he said, "Why are you making such a commotion? The child isn't dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. And he put them all outside and took the father and the mother and those who were with him. And they went in to where the child was, and taking her by the hand, he said, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking. She was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this. And he told them to give her something to eat. You know, I was upstairs yesterday, and I was working out. I've got all these back and shoulder and neck exercises that I'm supposed to do for this bad neck of mine. And, I mean, you don't get a body like this from just sitting around eating Cheetos and watching TV. So,
Actually, that was the first time I did it all week long. So anyway, you know, when I was totally exhausted, I went over and there was a stack of old photographs there, and I picked up the photographs and I'm looking through the photographs, and a lot of them are pictures of me holding my children when they were babies. And you know that when you hold a child in your arm, you know, that baby eats and sleeps and giggles and smiles and coos and poos and cries a lot, some crying more than others. But that baby, and you know this, at that point in time, that baby doesn't know the loss of an important relationship. That baby doesn't know anything about depression or economic recessions. The baby doesn't lay awake at night worrying about her job or some problem that seems impossible to overcome. That baby just lies there in her mother's arms, safe and secure. But you know that baby, as it grows up, she's going to learn that life is less and less safe and more complicated. She's going to learn about hot stoves and electrical outlets and bee stings and sand spurs, and she's going to find out that other children can say and do things that are very hurtful. She's going to learn the sadness that comes when her parents say, hey, we're moving to another state, and there's not one thing that she can do about it. She's going to learn the heartbreak of breaking up with somebody that she loves. And it's all a part of growing up. Thankfully, not the only part, but it's the hard part. Learning what life in this broken world is really like. Now, my growing up years were good, very good. In fact, I grew up in Florida on the Space Coast in a kind of wonder years kind of neighborhood. I had parents that loved each other, and they loved me. I had good friends. In high school, I played in a rock band, enjoyed some degree of popularity. Pretty much everything I tried to do, I could do. I found I could make certain things happen, and I could prevent certain things from happening. And I went off to college, the one I really wanted to attend, and the one that all of you wanted to attend, but you didn't get in, Florida State, to be a doctor. But I changed my mind and ended up a high school math teacher. Fell in love, and after graduation got married, and you know, lived in the small town in Georgia for about 3 years. Went on staff at a church there, and then decided to go to seminary. And up until about age 30, everything seemed to be going along pretty well. No major obstacles. Planned my work, worked my plan. And over time, when life goes along like that, I think what happens is you begin to think that when things go reasonably well, you develop this mindset that if everything you do is right, then everything will turn out right. And you begin to think that you're pretty much in control of your life until something happens. You end up hating your job. You're hit with all kinds of unexpected pressures. Your the promises that someone made to you don't happen. A good friend turns on you. Your income dries up. The x-ray comes back from the doctor and there's a spot on it. Your child has learning problem or grades go down. I mean, here you are one moment and you're cruising along. Everything is going just like you planned. And the next moment, it's like you're on this windy road going down a hill and you hit the brakes and nothing happens. And it's like you're speeding out of control. And what do you say at a time like that? You say, I've lost control. I've lost control of my life. What's happening? And I cannot tell you how many times I've said, I'm just not in control. But that's not true. The fact is, we don't lose control of our lives. The fact is that we were never in control of our lives. What we lost was the illusion that we were in control. And that's a hard, hard lesson to learn. So hard, in fact, that when it happens, most of us try to maneuver and manipulate and to plan and to plot and to pray, thinking there's got to be some way to work this thing out to get everything back on track. And we look for some formula, some solution to get us back into control so our life will turn out the way that we want. But what I'm continuing to learn or trying to learn is that it can't be done. We live in a broken world, and sometimes life will just not cooperate with our plans. We simply cannot control everything that happens to us. Sometimes all we can do is choose how we will respond to what happens to us, and that, too, is a very, very hard lesson to learn. Now, the Bible is full of this kind of thing. We've seen it already in the in the Gospel of Mark. In chapter 4, Jesus and the disciples are in a boat out on a lake. A hurricane-like storm comes up. Sails being ripped apart. Waves are swamping the boat. They think they're going to die. They're scared to death. The sea is beyond their control. And so they go back to Jesus, wake him up. He says, "Why are you so afraid?" They're going, "Don't you care that we're perishing?" He says, "Why are you so afraid?" And with just a simple command, the wind and the waves cease, and everything's quiet and calm again. And they go, "Who is this man who can control the wind and the waves?" And they get to the other side of the lake, and as soon as they get to the other side of the lake, bam, right out of the boat, this naked, demon-possessed man, actually a man full of a whole army of demons, comes running toward him. The guy lives in the graveyard. We're told over and over again, nobody can control this man, but Jesus can, because with a simple command, the man is sitting clothed in his right mind. Every last demon is gone, and his sanity is completely restored. And then we come to this story. And Jesus and his disciples have gone back across the lake, back to where they were the day before. And again, they're barely out of the boat when this man named Jairus, a local leader of a synagogue, runs up. He falls down in front of Jesus, just like the demon-possessed man, kind of an interesting tie there. And he's up against something he can't control, not a storm, not an unclean spirit, but his 12-year-old daughter is dying, literally. She's at death's door, and there's not one thing that he can do about it except lay in the dirt in front of Jesus and beg and plead, "Please, please help me, rescue my daughter. Please come lay your hands on her so she will live." And Jesus agrees to go with him. By the way, one thing I noticed in all these stories is whenever someone comes to Jesus, he always helps them. Always. He never ignores them or rejects anyone who's desperate enough are humble enough to ask for help. And so Jesus agrees to go with him. And I imagine they're walking at a quick pace. I can imagine Jairus kind of taking Jesus, you know, and trying to hurry him along. But then all of a sudden, on the way to the house, everything grinds to a complete halt. I mean, something happens that, again, puts Jairus totally out of control. There's an old woman in the crowd. She's been sick for about 12 years, some kind of chronic illness, some kind of internal bleeding with some kind of bodily discharge that made her ceremonially and socially unclean in that religious culture. A woman no doctor had been able to help. In fact, the way the Mark puts it, it's kind of a derogatory thing. The doctors had just made her suffer more. Anyway, the woman pushes her way through the crowd. She sneaks up behind Jesus. She's thinking, if I can just touch up the hem of his garment, just a piece of clothes, then I can be made well. And somehow, some way, she wiggles her way through the crowd, touches Jesus, and miraculously, she's healed. And this is kind of weird, but somehow Jesus knows that power has somehow gone out of him, and he stops dead in his tracks, and he says, "Who touched me?" I mean, isn't that weird? He knows power's gone out of him, but he doesn't know who's touched him. Or at least that's the way the story reads. And his disciples are like, "Are you kidding me? Who touched me?" I mean, that's like that Cardinals quarterback trying to do a quarterback sneak into the end zone and being piled on by the entire Steeler defense, and the Kurt Warner going, "Who touched me?" from the bottom of the pile. It makes no sense. Crazy weird. And the woman, timid and fearful, knowing now that what she had done in secret is going to be made public, she makes her way back through the crowd, and notice verse 33, it says, the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and she fell down before Jesus. Everybody falls down before Jesus. And she told him the whole truth. In other words, she told him the whole story. In other words, she told him the entire 12-year medical history. You ever listen to an older person tell you their entire 12-year medical history? Shoot, you even listen to me tell you my recent medical history? I mean, it's going to take a while. I went to this doctor, and I went to that doctor, and he treated me like this, and he treated me, and then I was taking all these pills. She's telling him all this, and while Jesus patiently and tenderly listens to this woman, Jairus gets word that his daughter has died. Now, if you're Jairus, what are you thinking? I mean, if you're the disciple watching this whole thing, what are you thinking? I mean, what Jesus has just done makes no sense. These two people, Jairus and the woman, are on opposite ends of the social spectrum. They couldn't be any more different. And that's a very important part of the tension in the story right here, because Jesus didn't work the way people in his day would have expected. And so I want to look at the difference between Jairus and the woman so you understand how the tension builds in the story. First of all, stating the obvious, Jairus is a man. And in that day and in that time and in that culture, men had all the power. He had power, he had prominence, he had preference, he had priority, and she obviously is a woman. Jairus is the leader of a local synagogue, like a chairman of the elders in a local church. The woman, because she's unclean, she hasn't gone to synagogue for over 12 years, and she has zero status in that day and time. Jairus, though not stated in the text, but it would have been true, he would have been a well-to-do man. He would have been a rich man. The woman, we are told in the text, had spent everything she had on trying to get better. So Jairus is at the top of the social ladder. The woman is not even to the first rung of the ladder. And Jesus turns to the woman with absolutely no social and economic capital or power, and he gives her his full attention. He treats her as if there is no one else in the world but her, and he makes this highly respected man wait in the moment of his greatest need. Again, for Jairus, everything that's happening right here at this point in the story makes no sense. It's totally out of his control. Why does Jesus do that? Well, big picture, it's not unusual. If you go through the Bible, if you go through the Gospels, you'll find that very often different people are paired together to make a point. Like there's a Pharisee and a tax collector. There's a religious leader and a fallen woman. There's a good son and a bad son. There's a rabbi and there's a Samaritan. And you have an insider and you have an outsider. And Jesus always seems to gravitate towards the outsider. Why? Well, because when you get to the end of the book of Mark, you find out that the way up is the way down. That the way to be great is to give your life away in service. Is the way to get righteousness is to admit that you have none. That the way to find life is to die, or to update that just a bit, that it means to give up control of your life and seek to let God control it. It's a complete reversal of the way the value system of the world works. The real Jesus doesn't come to people with status or power or pedigree. I love how Tim Keller puts it in one of his sermons. He says, Jesus seems more attracted to people who are the most messed up and who have messed up the most. He gravitates towards people who are the most messed up and who have messed up the most. And I want you to hear this morning. It doesn't matter who you are or what you've done. I don't care if you've been on hell's paid staff. I don't care how far you've fallen. Jesus, as he said earlier, he said, I've come to heal those who know they're sick. I can't help people who think that they're healthy and well. That's the big picture. But here, there's something else going on. In this passage, you see these two different people, Jesus weaving their stories together as yet another visual aid to help us see something about who he really is and better understand how what Jesus does is geared toward a certain end. It's very clear in this story that because of this interruption and this delay, we learn a whole lot about faith. Faith is an issue with the woman. Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Faith is an issue with Jairus. Don't be afraid. Only believe. There's something about faith here. Faith in Jesus' ability to do impossible things. Faith and his ability to control impossible things, which has been the theme so far in all these stories. In the storm, he has control over a whole army of demons, over incurable disease and death itself. He's really in control. But at this moment, to Jairus and to the messenger from his house, to the disciples and the whole crowd of people there, Jesus doesn't look like he's in control of anything. What he's done in taking so much time with this unclean woman, making Jairus, this highly respected man with an urgent need, making him wait, that makes no sense at all. But it's almost as if Jesus is saying to Jairus, Jairus, you can't hurry me. I will not be hurried. It doesn't matter that things seem like they've spun totally out of control. It doesn't matter that the future looks worse than the present. Don't be afraid. Just believe. But you can't hurry me. So what are we supposed to learn about faith at this point in the story? Because we got to stop here, because this is the tension point of the story. This is the point when nothing makes sense. This is the point when he gets word his daughter's dead and Jesus says, only believe. This is the point that's beyond anyone's control. Well, the first thing we learn that is that God's grace and God's help don't always operate according to our schedule and our timing. God's timing will sometimes make you feel like things are more out of control than when you first started coming to him for help. His help never seems to come when you want it, when you think you need it. His grace never operates according to our schedules and our timing. And when Jesus looks at Jairus and says, only believe, I think he's looking over the top of Jairus' head, and he's looking at us. He's looking at every reader of the book of Mark, and he's saying, remember chapter 4? Remember in chapter 4 in that storm where I tried to teach you that my care for you is compatible with going through storms? Remember that? Well, here I'm telling you that my love and grace and care for you are compatible with what seems to be incomprehensible delays. Again, I like how Keller puts it. He says, it's not that Jesus says, I will not be hurried, but I love you anyway. It's that Jesus is saying, I will not be hurried because I love you. Because I love you. But here's the deal. But if you insist on imposing your timetable on me, Jesus says, you will never feel loved and cared for by me, and it will mostly be your fault. You see that? You hear that? When Jesus doesn't operate according to your timetable, it might feel like things are totally out of control, out of your control, out of God's control. And in that moment, if you insist on imposing your timetable on God, it'll be impossible to experience God's love and care, but it will be your fault. Now hear me, I'm not saying that to beat you up. I'm saying it because it's true, and it's a part of what we're supposed to learn from these interwoven stories. It's how the real Jesus works, and to be honest with you, it's what I need to hear and believe probably more than you. So everything grinds to a halt, and we see that God's timing is not always our timing. And we may not understand his delays, but his delays don't mean that he doesn't care. The second thing we learn here is when you come to Jesus at a time when everything seems to be out of control, you have to give more than you originally expected, but you get far more than you ever imagined possible. When you come to Jesus and when life is out of control, you got to give more, but you will get more than you originally expected. Things don't always work out the way you want, and you end up giving more and getting more than you bargained for. I mean, look at Jairus. He comes to Jesus. He's risking everything. He's risking his reputation as a synagogue leader. Remember, he's one of the bad guys. He's one of the ones that want Jesus dead. But he's giving all that up because he's desperate. Jesus is his only hope, and he comes running to Jesus, and he's groveling in the dirt. Can you imagine his cronies around the outside of the crowd looking at him and going, man, what are you doing? Get up off your face. Are you crazy? He's willing to risk his reputation, his social position, his respect, his pride. He's willing to give it all up in hopes of getting Jesus to heal his daughter. He wants a healing, but he's going to get more than that. He's going to get a resurrection. He's going to get a resurrection. Because Jesus spent so much time with this woman, his daughter dies. And so what Jesus is demanding from him, a whole lot more faith because of this delay. Over all the voices in his head that are saying, it's over. The future is hopeless. Jesus says, only believe. And that's a test of faith that went way beyond anything he had in mind when he first came to Jesus. And then look at this woman. This woman came to Jesus, and what did she want? She wanted to touch and run. She wanted a quick, secret healing. But Jesus won't have it. He forces her to go public. And that was very risky. Why? Because she was ceremonially unclean. She shouldn't even have been in a crowd because everybody that would have bumped against her in that religious culture would have become unclean. She could have been stoned to death had she been found out. But Jesus finds her out. And he insists that she go public. Why? Because she needs it. Why? Number one, because her faith needs to go deeper than, if I can just touch his cloak, I'll be healed. Her faith needs to go deeper than that. And two, she needs to be restored to the community. And that's exactly what happens. She gets far more than a healing. She's forced to give more by going public with her faith. And as a result, she's recognized as a daughter, just like the little girl. A daughter in the community of faith again. This woman who's been cut off for at least 12 years, she's restored. It's life-transforming. So she had to give more than she expected. And she had to exercise more faith than she expected. But by going public, she got more than she ever imagined. I think that's an important lesson here, because when life feels like it's spinning out of control and you go to Jesus for help, mark it down. You'll give more than you expected, but you'll gain far more than you ever imagined. But third, most of all, I think this delay teaches us that when things seem like they're spinning out of control, and remember, it's only the illusion that you're ever in control anyway, but when you think you've lost control, it's because there's something going on that you just can't see. Something God is doing in that moment you can't understand. You don't understand it right then, but it'll become clear later on. If it feels like God is ignoring you, overlooking you, not answering your prayer, not hearing you, it's because something else is going on that you don't yet understand. Look at it. As far as Jairus and Jesus' disciples are concerned, what Jesus, the great physician, has done, it not only doesn't make any sense, it's malpractice is what it is. It's ridiculous. It's incredulous that to let a little girl die to treat a woman who's been chronically ill for 12 years, who could have waited another hour. But you and I know something that the people in the crowd that day and the disciples that day didn't know. You and I know that it's no harder for Jesus to heal a disease or raise somebody from the dead. It's no harder for Jesus to cast out one demon or a whole army of demons because he has power and control over impossible things. There's no effort meter with Jesus that one thing is harder than the other. So let me ask you, is God delaying something in your life? And you're just at a point, you're just ready to give up because as far as you can see, it's hopeless. And you're kind of mad at God because he's not working the way you wanted him to. Well, he's looking at you and he's saying, Jairus, he's saying something's going on that you just don't see. I'm doing something you don't understand. He's saying, don't be afraid, only believe. But it's hard to believe, isn't it? In those times, it's hard to believe. Now, hear me again. I want to be careful when I say this because I know some of you are going through really, really difficult times, and you're discouraged, and you're frustrated, and you're angry, and you're hurt, and when you look at the future, it looks hopeless. You've gone through very difficult things, and you're still going through very difficult things. And you feel helpless and you feel hopeless and you're going, God, what are you doing? I've been praying about this and praying about this and things are going from bad to worse. Hear me. Let me just personalize it because this is so true of me. a lot of the emotional turmoil that I deal with in my life when God doesn't do what I want Him to do, when I want Him to do it, is simply the result of my own arrogance. You see, when it feels like things are out of control, and when I look at God's delays in my life that make things seem like they're going from bad to worse, when I look at my future and I can't see a way through, when I pray and I beg for help and I'm not getting the help that I need, sometimes my frustration, my willingness to blame somebody else, like it's been very easy for Jairus to blame this woman for his child dying, my anger at God for not giving me back control of my life, what is that? It's just plain arrogance. It's self-righteousness. It's self-centeredness welling up inside me, and maybe I don't say it out loud, but maybe I do. God, I know better than you how my life ought to go. Anybody know what I'm talking about? I'm thinking, I'm acting like I know better than God how my life ought to go. And if I, here's the deal though. If I admit that I'm not in control, that I've never been in control, and I yield trying to be controlled, yield trying to control my outcome and my future and God, you know what happens? That arrogance and that self-centeredness can be knocked out of my life through these delays that I don't understand. By me realizing I'm not in control, never been in control, and then yielding control in the delay, God's trying to chip that arrogance and that self-righteousness out of me. So He says to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe. But only believe what? Isn't that the question? I mean, telling Jairus not to be afraid, just believe, that had to sound, at this time in his life, that had to sound like, Jairus, jump to the moon. I mean, it's totally impossible. Believe what? What was Jairus supposed to believe? Jesus is saying, Jairus, believe that I have some facts that you don't have. Jairus, trust that I'm doing something you can't see. He's saying, Jairus, stay open to me working in your life in a way you don't understand right now. Jesus is saying, if it looks like I'm doing something that makes no sense, just figure that I have some facts you don't have. And though it may look like things are getting even worse and worse and worse, it doesn't matter how bad things can be, because Jesus is saying, I can do the impossible. There's not one thing that's harder for Jesus than the other. And that's exactly what we see at the end of this incredible story. The plot thickens. For Jairus, the ante has been upped. The little girl is dead, and Jesus looks at him and says, okay, let's go to your house. And so they start out for the house. And He takes Peter and James and John, and they walk into the house, and everybody's weeping and they're wailing. And, it's loud commotion, nothing like when you go to a funeral home today. And Jesus walks into all that loud commotion, and He says, what's this about? Child isn't dead, the child's sleeping. Which everybody knows is ridiculous. I mean, they know when somebody's dead. So why did Jesus say that? Well, He says that because of what He does next. Verse 41, takes the father, the mother, Peter, James, and John, and He takes the child by the hand, and He says to her, Talitha kumi, which is very odd that Mark would put Aramaic in the middle of Greek. Mark's readers, their native tongue is Greek, but he preserves the Aramaic which Jesus would have spoken, not because it's some incantation like abracadabra, but because it has... Mark got his information from Peter, and this must have really been burned into Peter's mind, how Jesus treated this little girl. Because Talitha kumi means, get up, little girl. But it's even more precious than that. It's more gentle than that. About the closest translation I could find would be, sweetie, get up. like a mother that goes in and sits down on the bed of her daughter, her young daughter, and says, "Sweetie, honey, get up. It's time to eat breakfast. It's time to get ready for school." And this dead little girl, Luke says the spirit came back into her. She was dead. She wasn't asleep. She sat straight up, and they gave her some breakfast. I mean, see the point. Jesus has power over death. Again, there's no incantation. There's no calling on a higher power. He doesn't break a sweat. He's facing the impossible. Worse than a hurricane, worse than a whole army of demons, worse than an incurable disease, Jesus is facing the ultimate enemy of the human race. And it's no harder for him to raise this girl from the dead than simply just take her by the hand and say, "Sweetie, come on. Get up." And he pulls her right through death and back into life. You see, if Jesus has you by the hand, even death itself is nothing more than a good night's sleep. Only believe. If I have you by the hand, even death itself is nothing more than a good night's sleep. And I'm like, oh my goodness. It's not just power. It's gentle power that he has. So why is it that we're so eager to hurry him along? Why is it so hard for us to trust him when he has this kind of power, when he has this kind of care? Well, it's because there's a rub in this story, isn't there? All four stories, the storm, the demon-possessed man, the woman's incurable disease, Jairus' little daughter being raised from the dead, there's a rub here. What's the rub? What's the tension? Well, we don't always experience these things. Everybody that came to Jesus in these stories got their prayers answered. But sometimes our storms go on and on. Sometimes our demons continue to torment us. Sometimes we have to live with a debilitating disease. Sometimes our loved one dies. That's the rub. That's the tension for us. And so when Jesus looks over Jairus' head and he looks at you and he looks at me and says, "Don't be afraid, only believe." The question is, only believe what? That our prayers will be answered the way we want them to? That things will always turn out the way we think they should? That we'll always get what we want? That's the way it seems to work in these stories with these people. They call on Jesus. They get what they want. The storm stops. The demons depart. The incurable disease is cured. The little girl, dead girl, gets up and eats breakfast. Oh, yeah, there's some obstacles here, some delays, some weird stuff going on. But in the end, everybody gets what they want. And so what we really want to know is, what did they do right? That if we can just do it, then we'll get what they got, which is to stay in control of our lives. But that's not what these stories are about at all. They are not stories about how to get God to do what you want. They are not stories to tell us how to stay in control of your life. These are stories about who Jesus really is and how Jesus really works. And Mark wrote these stories for one reason and one reason only, and that is to tell us that this Jesus is no ordinary man. That this Jesus is the Son of God, God in the flesh, and he's saying, believe it. Believe him, not to get what you want, but so he can give you what you need most. That's what Mark tells us over and over again, that Jesus is preaching. The kingdom of God is breaking in. The life-giving power of God is breaking into the world through what Jesus is doing in these incredible, impossible things. The loving, caring power of God is being made personal. And the question is, the tension for us, the rub is, if he healed the woman who had been sick 12 years, if he raised the little girl from the dead, if he gave these people what they wanted, why doesn't he give me what I asked for? N.T. Wright addresses this question. He says, the question misses the whole point of the larger story Mark is telling. Now listen to this. Just as Jesus wasn't coming to be a one-man liberation movement in the traditional revolutionary sense, so also Jesus wasn't coming to be a one-man emergency medical center. He was indeed starting a revolution. And he was indeed bringing God's healing power, but his aim went deeper, farther. These things were signs of the real revolution. Signs of the real healing that God was to accomplish through His death and resurrection. Signposts are important, he says, but they're not the destination. For that, we have to read on. These stories are not saying, look at what Jesus did to these people. If you get it right, He'll do the same thing for you. They're not about that. Now, He may calm your storms. Many of my storms have been calmed by Jesus. He may deliver you from your demons and give you back your sanity. He may heal you of that disease. He may give you that healing. He may answer your prayers for that loved one who's dying and give them back their life. He may very well do that as a sign that He has that kind of power, that He breaks into the world. He does that sometimes, but that's not what these stories are teaching. That's not what the message of the gospel is. Because remember, the original readers, the ones to whom Mark wrote this book, were Christians going through persecution and suffering. They were being hunted down and put in jail and tortured and burned at the stake and murdered and fed to lions. And some of these people, when the plague hit Rome, these Christians stayed behind and they ministered to the sick. And they got sick and they died because they gave their life away in service to people to show them the love and the power of God. Mark wrote these stories to give those people hope, not hope that Jesus would save them and keep them from all harm and all suffering and all persecution and all disease and all death, but hope that God was working in these things in ways they wouldn't be able to understand until maybe eternity. And by believing that, maybe their faith would outgrow their fear. You see, that's the options. Don't be afraid. Only believe. You see, we can panic and fall overboard, or we can calmly ride out the storm. We can despair, or we can wait quietly for sanity to return. We can be afraid of sickness and death, or we can believe that Jesus' loving power is enough to see us through, no matter what happens. And by the way, I don't think it's one or the other. I don't think it's either or. I don't know of anyone who believes, really believes, all the time. Because Jesus is always up in the ante. He's always stretching our faith, sometimes to the breaking point. So we're always living in the tension between fear and faith for the purpose of growing our faith and showing us His loving, gentle power is at work for us in ways that sometimes we don't understand. So, when life spins out of control and you feel disappointment and despair and you feel dejected and defeated and depressed, and when you're afraid that what's coming in the future is going to be worse than the present, Jesus says, only believe. He says, trust me. Trust that I am working to help you, not always in your time and in your way, not always in ways you can see and understand right now, and certainly not in a way that gives you the illusion that you're back in control of your life and you can get from me exactly what you want, but believe I'm helping you in the way that you need most, in a way that's continually teaching you to move from fear to faith and from fear to faith. And yeah, in that process, you might have to give up more than you thought on the front end, but you gain far more than you ever imagined. What you get is Him. Would you bow for me, with me? God, we want to believe these things. We want to believe them in the midst of the things that we're going through. And most of us are struggling to believe them. And so would you help us in our unbelief? In Jesus' name, amen.